This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a story that Bob Edwards used to tell that captures pretty well the kind of regard Cokie Roberts has earned among her colleagues, and among listeners, for that matter. Apparently, some years ago, there was a rather serious discussion among the producers at National Public Radio about whether to reveal, shall we say, certain truths about the identity of Santa Claus in a story for, I think it was Morning Edition. After some fairly rigorous and highfalutin debate about the importance of truth and how many young believers were actually a part of the NPR demographic, the question was put to Cokie, who, Bob says, dispatched the matter in a flash, saying simply, "Of course we won't air that." Now, like any good piece of apocrypha, I'm not really sure how much of the story is true, and I'm not really sure it matters. It does reveal a quality that seems to have propelled Cokie Roberts through her career, a kind of unvarnished common sense. It's certainly one of the traits that makes her valuable as an observer of the country's political system. Over the past several years, Cokie Roberts has been exploring the role of women in history and modern society. She's the author of Founding Mothers and, more recently, Ladies of Liberty. Today on the program, Cokie Roberts is joining us to talk about the lessons she's learned about women, lessons she's also drawn from her own experience. We invite you to join the conversation. We'll be taking your calls at about 20 after the hour today. 585-WEST is the number, 585-9378, or you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Cokie Roberts is a senior news analyst for National Public Radio and a political commentator for ABC News. She's won numerous awards for her work, including an Emmy and the Edward R. Murrow Award. Roberts co-writes a syndicated weekly newspaper column with her husband, Stephen Roberts. And Cokie Roberts joins us today by phone from her office in Washington. Cokie Roberts, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Doug, and thank you for that lovely introduction. You know, I don't remember the Santa Claus story, but I can tell you that if anybody had put such a thing to me, I certainly would have had that response.
Good, good, okay. So at least that part's accurate, right?
How silly can you get? Ruining little children's lives.
Absolutely. I want to begin by asking you, I'm wondering, Cokie Roberts, what it was like at the dinner table when you were a kid. I mean, your father, of course, Hale Boggs, Louisiana congressman. Your mother, Lindy Boggs, earned and served in that seat for a number of years after he was killed in 1972. What was it like? You had to be fast on your feet, I wonder? Or what
yes,
was that?
You did, and it was very political. That's certainly true. I've actually just come from an event at the National Archives, our wonderful repository of America's records, and somebody there was telling me, reminding me about going out to the house and as a teenager and watching my father come home at night and talk about what had happened all day and how just fascinating it was. And that's true. I mean, we were very lucky in that he included us in his political life. So we grew up hearing a great deal and learning a great deal and being very much part of it. When people, you know, would come to dinner, we were part of the conversation. So I think it was a wonderful way to grow up.
Was it clear what was expected of you? And I wonder how that was expressed.
Well, it was certainly expected that you behave.
Yeah, right.
I mean, it was. I always joke that the only thing worse is probably being the minister's child. You know, the fact is that you were told that, you know, anything that you did could show up on the front page of the paper.
Yeah.
And so make sure what you did was not something that would embarrass the family. So that was that expectation was certainly there.
I wonder if there was anything broader. I mean, you've talked, I remember once, about feeling a sense of obligation.
Yes, and I actually do feel guilty about never having run for public office because I'm the only member of my original nuclear family who did not. And I have a high regard for people who do take on that role and make those sacrifices. But I ended up instead, you know, trying to explain what's going on in the world of government and politics rather than participating. But I do feel a tremendous obligation to participate in other areas of civic engagement and service, particularly as I get older.
You have said that when you were growing up, you saw that women ran everything.
That's true.
What do you mean?
Well, in Washington, in that era, this is the 1950s, the fact is the city was still didn't have home rule, and the women who were spouses of members of Congress combined with local women, particularly African-American women, and they ran all of the public welfare programs and the the hospitals and the schools, and they ran everything. And they also were very involved in politics and running political campaigns and voter registration drives and all of those things. I mean, there was never an election of my life that my mother wasn't deeply involved, and often on the road to get voters involved and kids, particularly young people, involved. And it was just part of life.
So when did you notice the kind of disconnect, that this maybe wasn't exactly how it worked elsewhere, or that women weren't being given credit anyway for their role?
Well, of course, by the time I grew up and then was married and in the workforce, as people always say, there's nothing quite so feminizing as getting married and going into the workforce, you just start to realize that all of those wonderful women that you grew up with weren't given their due, and people were quite ready not to give me my due, not to hire me for jobs that I was capable of doing and qualified to do because I was a woman. And I think that was, the women of my era all had that experience where we suddenly woke up one fine day and said, "What's going on here?
Oh,
they're not treating us like the people we are."
I wonder what that decision was like for your mother, whether or not when your father was killed, that decision whether she should run for that seat. Was that a difficult decision?
No, it really wasn't. Huh. She always says she doesn't even remember making it. Hmm. It was just sort of the fire horse heard the bell and took off.
Yeah.
And it was so obvious that she should do it. She had run the district. By that time, he was majority leader.
Right.
She had run the district office for years. She had always run his political campaigns. And everybody knew that she was the most qualified person for the job. And it just never occurred to any of us that she wouldn't run.
Was that a lesson the balance that she struck in your life, was that a lesson you applied to yourself when you thought about, being a mother on one hand and, getting a career on the other hand?
Sure it was. And also, I was very lucky because my mother, most women of my generation found that their mothers were great guilt inculcators. And my mother was the great guilt eraser.
Huh.
She basically said, "You're fine, your kids are fine, you've grown up fine, they'll grow up fine." And that was wonderful.
What was the?
And in fact, they have, by the way.
Yeah, good for you.
They're lovely adults with lovely children of their own.
Yes, you're a grandmother of four. We need
five.
Five now.
There's a new one.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
What was your inspiration, if it was one particular thing, to write Founding Mothers? Was it one of those kinds of epiphanies, or was it something that you just had been thinking about?
I think it was it was mainly that it was something I had been thinking about. As I said, the women of my era were so influential. And when you cover Congress and politics as long as I have, you spend an awful lot of time with the Founding Fathers because you have to go back and read the debates on things like the right to bear arms or freedom of religion. Or I went back just the other day to read the debate on why a natural-born citizen for president as opposed to someone who's been naturalized, like Arnold Schwarzenegger, just say, for instance. And you spend a huge amount of time with the men of that era, and it is a unique era in American history, and I knew that the women had to be equally influential, as the women of my era. And so I puzzled about them, and then when Steve and I wrote From This Day Forward about marriage, we included a chapter on John and Abigail Adams' marriage. And when I saw the letters back and forth between them and realized how very alone she was and how she had to do everything. She had to, of course, raise the children and take care of the old people, but she had to support the family, and she had to she was expected to be a great patriot to the cause. And, oh, by the way, the British were coming. She had to fend off the British. So Once I read her letters, I realized that this is something I really had to do.
This notion of being alone was a kind of recurring theme among the women you explored.
Absolutely. The men were gone for long periods of time, either in Congress or in the Army or off on diplomatic missions.
You've said that this was really difficult to research. And I wondered, was it thought that the experiences of women in that era somehow wouldn't be noteworthy to history? Because you've said it's difficult to find the documents.
Absolutely. The sense that they were not important permeates the period, first of all. And it's understandable. I mean, their names are not on the documents. Their names are not on the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution. They were not the generals in the Revolution or the members of Congress or president or cabinet in the new nation. So you certainly can understand why it is the men who were studied. Mm. But, of course, that's always only half the story. And not only do you get a much fuller picture of what the country was like and the degree of dedication of the citizens of the country at the time of resisting the British and the whole fight for independence, but you also get a better sense of the men because you see them through the eyes of their family members, and that's a much more personal account.
You know, it's interesting also in the book is that you note that while John Adams and Thomas Jefferson and others are, you know, pouring out their hearts in their diaries, that it was figured that, you know, this was too personal to reveal all this kind of personal stuff if you were a woman.
Well, I think the women did feel that way. Martha Washington, we believe, destroyed all of her own correspondence. Her grandson saw her burning some letters shortly before she died, and her correspondence is gone.
Yeah.
And so we assume that she did that, and we assume that that's the reason, that she considered it too personal. Abigail Adams regularly asked her correspondents to destroy her mail, and fortunately they had the good sense not to. But it was often when she was saying something that she thought was embarrassing, perhaps, or it would be considered inappropriate for a woman to be talking about, because, of course, her letters were full of politics.
Sure.
And so I think that when the women had the opportunity, they did in their own history.
And what a shame Thomas Jefferson destroyed the
I know. I find that one really hard to wrap my mind around, because the explanation is that he destroyed all of Martha Jefferson's correspondence because he was so brokenhearted upon her death. But that just doesn't seem to me to be the kind of thing you do when you're brokenhearted.
Yeah, yeah.
Who knows? He was a very complicated man.
Indeed. you've said, Cokie Roberts, that having the sensibilities of being a political reporter actually helped you in writing this
Absolutely.
Book.
Absolutely. In fact, I think it would be difficult to write otherwise, because there's a lot of material here that requires beating it into submission, you know, getting it down on paper in some coherent form that is readable and understandable, because there were a lot of different political ideas going on, a lot of movements and causes that were shaping the nation. And unless you are used to writing about those kinds of things and used to making them into English, I think it would be very hard.
I wonder what the influence was of the fact that this was the American experience, and this place, this time, did it have a kind of obligation, a kind of expectation for these women? Do you think?
Yes, I think it did, and that surprised me, Doug. That was something I did not expect to find, was how very explicitly they were called upon to partake in the cause, and from the time of resistance to the British taxes on through the war and the formation of the new nation. And I think you're quite right, that the fact that this was the new world, not the old, that they were the whole experiment of America was trying new things and coming a new place to make a better world. I think that that did engage the entire populace in a way that you probably would not have seen in Europe.
I wanted to ask Cookie Roberts, what was home for you? I mean, you spent your formative years in Washington and in New Orleans, but what did you regard as your sort of home base? What was
We always referred to Louisiana as home, yeah. Which is normal for congressional families. I from the time I was in third grade, I started going to school year-round here. Before that, we went to school half-year each place. My parents moved in 1952 to the house that I live in today. I guess that is, you would certainly have to call that home. It's a home I've lived in for more than 50 years.
It was a balancing act in some ways, I mean, because Louisiana was clearly different from the kind of culture of Washington.
Well, I think that that's one of the very useful things about the Congress and about the House of Representatives in particular, that there is always a tremendous desire and ability and necessity to stay in touch with the district. And so that not only the members but their families do feel a tremendous attachment to the place called home, but you do also develop wonderful friendships and relationships in Washington as well. But, you know, I don't think that they're all that. I mean, New Orleans is different from any place in the country.
Right.
And I must say, it just continues to amuse me that you have the Utah Jazz. Just what you always think of in Utah. But anyway, I think it would be wrong to think that Washington is that different from the rest of the country, and particularly when you're a kid here, you know, going to the Catholic school that I went to, most of the kids' families weren't involved in politics at all. They were, you know, part of the local community.
It's been a number of years, but I remember once, I think it may have actually been in Morning Edition, you were asked to give the proper pronunciation for that city, New Orleans.
That's true. That was during the 88 Republican Convention, which was in New Orleans, and everybody had a different pronunciation for it. So Bob Edwards and I did a whole routine on how do you pronounce the name of the city.
Well, clear it up again for us. New Orleans.
New Orleans, which is, when you think about it, it's basically saying New Orleans very fast. New
right. Well, along that line, not to talk too much about New Orleans, but Ted sends this email wondering, he's apparently on his way to New Orleans at some point.
Lucky him.
Wants to know, what is the one restaurant in the Crescent City that we must not miss?
Commander's Palace in the Garden District.
Okay.
Run by the indomitable Ella Brennan. He'll love it.
Great. Let's take a phone call. Rich is with us, calling from Orem. Rich, welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to talk to you, Cookie.
Nice to talk to you. Thank you for calling.
It seems to me that it's pretty easy to believe that the founding mothers, if you will, founding families, were much different than our families are today. In your research, was that confirmed, reaffirmed to you, or did you find that we're still kind of the same kind of families struggling with the same kind of things?
Well, I think that, you know, I'm not someone who thinks that human beings are all that malleable, and I think that that there's much more to recognize in these families than to find foreign. You know, people struggling with the same problems of supporting the family and trying to do the right thing by the children and the right thing by each other, and particularly missing each other enormously when they were away for these long periods of time. They had bigger challenges because the 18th century was a lot harder to live in than the 21st century. And as I say, these women particularly had big challenges because it was in an era when they could not own married women had no legal rights at all. They couldn't own property. In fact, the clothes on their backs were owned by their husbands. So there they were on their own and having to cope on their own without the kinds of legal rights and comforts that you have today.
Would you say then that you've gained a sense of reverence for them?
Absolutely, and I do think that a lot of us today are sissies, you know, that these women were tough. And of course, they were also having babies every couple of years and losing many of their babies. It was heartbreaking, and they were heartbroken. I mean, this notion that it was a different time and people expected to lose children, that's just absurd. These women were heartbroken when they would lose a baby. And it was a very, very difficult time, and they were incredibly admirable. At one point, Abigail Adams wrote to John and said, you know, we women are the best patriots because we are suffering all of the hardships and making the sacrifices for the cause, and if we succeed, we're not going to get anything from it. We're not going to hold high office or be held in high acclaim. We're not even going to be able to vote. And still, we are making the sacrifices for the cause. And she was right.
Rich, we're glad you called.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Kathy has been waiting in Salt Lake. Kathy, welcome.
Yes, thank you. Good morning. I had a question about Condoleezza Rice. She's black and a woman, and I feel she's being groomed to run for presidency. Is that a possibility?
What do you think, Cokie Roberts? It would have been the idea of a woman running for president two women running for president seems actually quite real.
I think Condoleezza Rice is a very, very smart and interesting woman, and I thought actually that George Bush should have put her on the ticket back in like 2002, when it wouldn't have been a political move or seen as a political move. Told Vice President Cheney that he could continue in sort of an advisory capacity, but politically he could put Condoleezza Rice on the ticket. And I think that would have shaken up American politics in a way that that we really couldn't anticipate. But that didn't happen, and I think now she's in the position where she would have to actually run for president as opposed to be vice president. And that is a very tough thing to do, and it's almost impossible to do as your first elected office. With the only non-governors, or really it's governors we tend to elect for president, and the only ones that haven't been have been generals. So I think that, and with the rare, and vice presidents, of course.
Sure.
And then, you know, only twice in our history have we elected someone directly from the Senate, and want someone directly from the House. So, the fact of her trying to run for president, having run for no other office, I think, is very, very difficult, if not impossible. And a senior Republican said the other day on this subject, he said, you know, if she were going to do that, she would have to be right now spending most of her lunches in Iowa. Mm. And right now, she's spending more of her lunches in Paris.
Right.
And she probably thinks that's a better deal. But she is a very, very smart and very interesting woman. And I wouldn't be surprised to see her stay in public life and perhaps run for the Senate from California or something like that.
Kathy, thanks.
Thank you.
So is the political culture in this country, the culture, I suppose, in general, is it, if the right candidate came along, would it be ready to elect a woman president?
Yes, I think so. I do think so. I think that you have now enough women in place to be credible in the state houses, in the Congress, in the Supreme Court. And I think that that the idea of putting one of those women in the top office in the land is something that people are, if it's the right woman and it's the right time, as you say, I think that people will be receptive to that. I used to think, Doug, that it would only happen that the more likely thing, and I still think this is more likely, is that a woman gets elected vice president, and then, you know, that something happens to the guy
one way
or the other, and she becomes president.
I wanted to ask you about how you are thinking these days about the, the condition of feminism. You once said that one of the difficulties of being a woman today, or even the hardest part, is the internal part rather than the external part.
I think there's a lot that is true. That of course there are still. I wouldn't for a second say that there are not external pressures.
Sure.
And there's still discrimination. I mean, all you have to do is take a look around the boardrooms of the major corporations in America to see how few skirts there are, and that is, of course, where the power is, and that is the next big hurdle to try to overcome. But I think that the pressures among ourselves, from woman to woman, and then internally in the person of a single woman, a woman, are very high, because we want to be good mothers, we want to be good wives, we want to be contributing members of society, as well as to do well in our chosen fields. And putting all of that together can be very, very difficult. And the fact that there's still, in 2005, an argument going on about is it better to stay home with children or go into the workforce, as if most women have that choice. Most women don't have that choice at all.
Yeah.
This is, an upper middle class to upper class discussion. But the fact that that conversation is still going on without any resolution shows you, I think, what the internal conflicts are.
Let's go back to the phones. Annie is joining us on the line from Sandy. Hi, Annie.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
And I'm a very big fan. So
thank you.
It's an honor talking with you.
That's very kind of you.
What I was wondering is, at the end of the Clinton time, was an idea called universal child care. I was very involved with a national organization for young children. We were all very excited. Then Bush entered, and it was dropped. And my point is that for working women, this would have been a wonderful thing, but not only that, but also for our children of America. I'm just wondering, in your opinion, do you ever come across this idea, or is this going to be dropped forever? It's too socialist or something else?
I haven't come across it, although your Senator Orrin Hatch has certainly done a great deal on the subject of child care. And as he always says, I might ideologically like it better for women to stay home, but they're not at home. They can't be at home. They need to raise their families. And so he has been one of the great proponents of daycare legislation in Congress. But I think that the workplace needs to be considerably more family-friendly, not just to mothers, but to caretakers of all sorts, because the truth is it's not just the years that you have children at home that you're going to find yourself torn between work and family. There are your parents to take care of as they get older. There's a spouse. When my sister was dying, I was in my 40s, and my children were grown, but I was certainly called upon and wanted to be called upon to be with her while she was desperately ill. So I think that the workplace has to adapt to all of life's needs for caretaking, because that is something that women do. We do take care of the whole society, and it's a wonderful thing we do, and I rejoice in it, but the workplace should make it easier.
Annie, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Cookie Roberts, in your first book, We Are Our Mother's Daughters, you lay out that evolution of the so-called women's vote and how it really emerges beginning in around like 1980, I guess it was. And I'm wondering how you're seeing now the women's vote expressing itself in the last election, how it's evolved, if it has.
Well, in fact, it was the women's vote in some ways that defeated John Kerry, because the Democratic candidates traditionally since 1980 have been able to rely on a sizable women's vote. In 80, women started voting in the same numbers as men, and their votes showed up to be different from men. Basically, all things being equal, women tend to vote more Democratic for the same reasons that other people do. They are economically more vulnerable. Often they are older, and also the women's vote includes a large proportion of black women who are economically vulnerable. So that vote has been a reliably Democratic vote, and as more women have showed up to vote than men, it has been useful for the Democrats. In this past election, Yes, single women voted for John Kerry, but married women did not. And the marriage gap was really a bigger gap than the gender gap. And I think that that has to do with a couple of things. I think it had to do with being economically more secure in marriage than not in marriage. But also, I think it did have to do to some degree with the social issues.
So if it were true that, say, 10, 15 years ago, the woman's vote was an economic vote, because I think you've written, in fact, that, you know, this was not about abortion
for
women.
No, it was never about abortion. It was men and women vote the same way on abortion, and men and women voted the same way on the Equal Rights Amendment when it was a live topic. So these feminist, quote-unquote, issues do not separate the way men and women vote. It is economic issues and, to some degree, war and peace issues. And that, of course, is the other thing that we saw in this past election, was a sense on the part of many women that they were safer. Again, married women, mothers, that they were safer with George Bush than with changing horses in midstream. And I think that that also was very influential in terms of the vote.
So do you get a sense that the, 'cause there's always this conversation, at least lately, about, you know, where are Americans' values and what are those values? Do you see women's essential values changing or the way they're perceived?
No, I don't think so. I think that the women's essential values are the ones I've talked to,
yeah.
Talked about earlier in the broadcast. Mm. But I think that that people have to figure out how to live their values, and as I say, the society has to make it easier for people to live their values. And when you're making choices between two candidates, you're saying, you know, which one do I feel, and this is particularly true at the presidential level, which one do I feel more comfortable with? Which one will I feel like makes the right decisions over the next 4 years, no matter what issue comes up, because I can't possibly predict what the issues might be. And if even if I don't feel all that comfortable with that guy, do I at least feel more comfortable with him than with the other guy?
Yeah.
And I think that that whole set of calculations on the part of married women in 2004 led them to George Bush.
Corey is with us, calling from Lehigh, Utah. Corey, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
I know you addressed this earlier, but I just tuned in, and I was just curious how exactly the Clinton administration with Bill was going to affect Hillary's running.
Well, you know, it's hard to know. When she was running for Senate in New York, it was exactly those married women that she had trouble with, and I always joked that they were, you know, there was the 300-pound elephant in the room, and nobody ever wanted to bring it up. But, of course, what these women really wanted to ask her was, why didn't you kill him? I would have killed him. Why didn't you kill him?
Yeah, yeah.
But of late, her approval rating in New York is very high. It's like 65%, considerably higher than that of Republican Governor George Pataki. So at least people in New York State seem to be putting the Clinton administration behind them. And I think that there's a certain nostalgia for the Clinton administration, certainly in Democratic circles, so that I think that that would help her certainly in the primary, in the nominating process. But at the general election level, she is a very, very, very polarizing person, and she's got people who despise her and people who love her. And the question is whether that polarization is too great to overcome the people who feel negatively about her, or whether the people who feel positively about her can win the day. And school's out on that question.
Yeah. Corey,
okay.
Thanks.
Thank you, Doug.
You mentioned the word nostalgia, which made me think, Cokie Roberts, of a piece you did too long ago of Claude Pepper. I'm wondering if you are nostalgic for when Claude Pepper was, I'm thinking of the kind of statesmanship, the kind of political dynamic of that era. Is there something different these days?
Or oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. This is a much less civilized era, and we're talking about people who are quite vitriolic toward each other in the halls of Congress, who are unwilling or to cooperate with each other no matter what comes along. And I think it's now permeated the whole society that the kinds of emails that people send are just rude and offensive, and I find it all very dispiriting.
Do you think the political center is shrinking, that people are taking?
Oh, it definitely is shrinking.
Yeah.
We have seen survey after survey in the Congress of the percentage of people who considered themselves in the center shrinking dramatically from the post-World War II era on. It used to be that you had a sizable Republican minority that was mainly from the Northeast and some from the Midwest and some from the far West that were more moderate, that were conservative on economic issues, and but very progressive, as they would call it, on issues like civil rights and civil liberties, and then later on issues like abortion. And you had a group of Southern Democrats who were very conservative on those kinds of issues. And you could put together coalitions in the Congress that where people were would come to the middle, because that's where most of the members were and most of the voters were. And now you see polarization in the Congress. It's extreme. And in the electorate it is to some degree as well.
Any idea at all about why?
Well, there's a whole variety of reasons.
Yeah.
So part of it is that in the long period where the Republicans were spending their 40 years in the desert, not being in the majority, they started to feel that the only way that they could capture the House of Representatives was to attack the institution and try to bring it down. And so there was a lot of hostility then, and members have now in both parties have succeeded in drawing their seats so safely, as some of them say, the members of Congress are picking their voters rather than the voters picking their members of Congress, because they're doing these sophisticated districting lines with computers where they pick up all like-minded people.
Yeah.
And it makes them, it takes away a huge amount of accountability, because they have very safe elections. And they don't have to talk to anybody they disagree with. They don't have to listen to anybody. The districts are so homogeneous, with rare exceptions. So you've got Matheson's district there where he's always got a bit of a problem. But
right.
By and large, most members of Congress can count on a free ride. And so they don't have to be civil to each other. They don't have to listen to each other. They can just say my way or the highway and know that they're going to get reelected. And the other part of it is that they don't live here in the way that they used to. When I was growing up, you had you expected to see other politicians at church or in the PTA or in volunteer organizations. And everybody knew each other and socialized together and worked together on various causes. And because most members of Congress now leave their families back in the district, they don't have those kinds of relationships. And that's a great loss.
You said recently that in a country where there's no common religion, no common ethnicity, not even really a common language, that the thing that has always bound the country together is the Constitution. And now even that is in question.
Well, I don't think our allegiance to the Constitution is in question, but the fact is it's not just the Constitution, it's the Constitution and the institutions it created, which is the government. And if we start to pull apart on that subject and pull apart as a political body, I think that is a recipe for true disaster. You know, one of the wonderful things in this country has been that we have not suffered, with the horrendous exception of the Civil War, the kinds of hostilities that pull people apart in other countries when they are ethnically at war or denominations are at war or whatever. We have not had that, and I think that, that the reason is that we have had some kind of subtle understanding that if we ever started to fight along those lines, that there'd be no stopping it because we are so diverse. And so for the country to hold together, we have to be able to come together. And the place that we do that is in our political institutions. That's what Congress means. It means coming together. And so that when we are in a situation where it looks like we're flying apart instead of coming together politically, I think that is a big, huge red warning flag. It's interesting, though, Doug, you know, back in the period that I wrote about in Founding Mothers, that was true then, too.
Yeah.
Soon after the new nation was formed, the partisanship started right up and became unbelievably acrimonious, and the nation was genuinely in danger of dissolution because it was way too young and way too fragile to be able to sustain that kind of partisanship. And it was the women who held it together. They kept insisting that the men come together, sit down, break some bread together, have some wine or cider together, and behave at the end of the day. And it made a huge difference in keeping the country going.
Do you think this is an area where Democrats, who are certainly nationally, certainly locally here, casting about for some kind of strategy to take hold, do you think this is something that people might connect to? Do you think there's a kind of longing among, you know, the independent electorate anyway for more sort of civil discourse?
Well, I do, but you know, President Bush found when he was running in 2000 that was a very receptive, that his talk about bringing the new civility to Washington fell on very receptive ears. And in fact, he was surprised at how voters responded to that. But then he came, and he would say he tried to reach out to Democrats and that they weren't having it. The Democrats would say that the Republicans were just so thrilled to be in the majority around the government that they weren't listening to Democrats. But certainly what you can say is that the president's desire, such as it was, to bring civility to Washington has not happened.
It's interesting. George Washington griped about the coverage in the media that he got as well.
No, it was ever thus. And not only was the media vicious to him, or the media, the press, but also to Martha. I mean, this is not something new under the sun to have the families be part of the political equation.
I loved, well, not sure if I loved, but I loved that you included Peggy Shippen in the book.
She was quite a woman, wasn't she?
She was.
Yes, well, she's the exception that proves the rule when we talk about these women being great patriots. She was a spy, and she was Benedict Arnold's wife, and turns out that she was the instigator of the whole plot to hook up Arnold with the British. She had dated Major Andre, and she was in it from the beginning.
And we didn't know that. We didn't know that till recently.
We didn't know that until the middle of the 20th century. And you know, it just happened, Doug, that when I was doing the research, I was reading the books about Peggy Shippen Arnold in order. You start with the early 19th century books, and they all say, oh, no way she could have been involved. She was, you know, she didn't have the wherewithal to be involved. And then there was always a suspicion because Aaron Burr had said that she had fessed up to his lady love, who was a loyalist. But nobody trusted Aaron Burr, so you know his word didn't count for much. So the writings over the 19th century all essentially say, "Oh, she might not have been the best inspiration for an American patriot, but she certainly wasn't in it herself. And it wasn't until the mid-20th century when the British papers, which were at the University of Michigan, were looked into and released, that you found that her correspondence with Major André, and she was, as I say, absolutely in it from the beginning. And, of course, we should have been able to figure that out because the British Crown gave her a very healthy pension for the rest of her life after she and Benedict moved to England after the war, and gave her a pension for services rendered, her services rendered. So obviously they knew what role she had played.
Are you, what are you thinking about these days? Are you, is there something you're writing now or thinking about writing these days?
Yes, I'm writing a couple of things. I'm writing a children's version of Founding Mothers, and I'm also writing a sequel. The book was initially going to go through the election of John Quincy Adams because he's obviously literally the next generation. The last election before that had been James Monroe versus Rufus King, which was two founders still. But the book started getting very, very too big, way out of hand, taking over. So I stopped it with the election of John Adams, which was the first peaceful transfer of power and an indication that the country would survive. But I will now write the book that is the period from the election of John Adams to the election of John Quincy Adams, which has some wonderful periods of our history. It's early Washington, it's Abigail Adams' tenure as First Lady, which makes Hillary Clinton look like a shy retiring violet. It's the War of 1812 and Dolly Madison's heroism. And it's the Louisiana Purchase, which is members of my own family. So sure, it will be fun.
Let me ask you this finally. You have said that when you started writing the book, Founding Mothers, that you thought in some way that these women were going to be unique, the way that we talked about the men being unique. But in the end, you concluded, in fact, they weren't necessarily unique.
I think that's right. I think that they did what women do, which is that they put one foot in front of the other. They had to do it in remarkable circumstances, and they had to make tremendous sacrifices. But I think when women are called upon to do that, that they do that, and that is one of the things that that makes us a special group of people. And I think that I've certainly seen it in the life of the women that I know, just bearing up under hardship and carrying on, and that's what these women did.
Cokie Roberts, she's the author of Founding Mothers. Since our conversation, she's published a sequel to the book. It's called Ladies of Liberty, The Women Who Shaped Our Nation. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our engineer is Lewis Downey. Our operations director is Michael Havey. The program is directed by Mike Anderson, produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.